walk across the courtyard towards the library. I can hear the insects buzz and the leaves beneath my feet.
Good evening, Kodiak. Welcome to another episode of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the Kodiak Public Library Association. I'm Athenia, chair of the KPLA and host of your show tonight. I'm excited to say that the science fiction lovers out there will enjoy tonight's show. We have Anne Leckie joining us for the Beyond the Cover interview. Anne Leckie is the author of the popular trilogy that is the novels Ancillary Justice, Ancillary Sword, and Ancillary Mercy, published in 2013, 2014, and 2015, respectively. This series received a lot of recognition. Ancillary Justice, in particular, won the Hugo Award for Best Novel, the Nebula Award for Best Novel, the Arthur C. Clarke Award for Best Science Fiction Novel of the Year, the Locus Award for Best Fiction Novel, the British Science Fiction Association Award for Best Novel, the Kitschies Golden Tentacle for Best Novel, and some others, as well as being shortlisted for awards. So as far as debut novels and debut series is go for an author, Anne Leckie has done phenomenally well for herself. She's also a successful writer of short stories, and she has some great advice for writers starting out there. So stick around for that interview. That'll be up right away. After that on our show, Erin Star Hollow from the Kodiak Arts Council is here to chat with me a little bit and share with you what's going on for the Altered Book season that's happening this January and culminating on February 3rd. So I'm hoping you're all getting excited and making your altered book projects out there, getting ready to turn your projects in by February 1st. For more information on that, of course, stick around later in the show or visit the Kodiak Arts Council website at www.kodiakarts.org. And finally on our show for Lively Live Chats, Caitlin from the Kodiak Public Library joins me to talk about a book that she recommended to me, which I read and was one of my favorite young adult books of the year. It was The Scorpio Races by Maggie Stiefvater, and Caitlin and I have a little chat about why we liked it so much. That'll be fun too for all you young adult fiction readers out there. So all in all, it's a great show. I'm really excited for it. Before I begin, I want to give a small shout out to Leslie Leland Fields, the author we had last month on our Beyond the Cover segment, Kodiak's own Leslie Leland Fields. I'm happy to announce that the book Leslie Leland Fields just wrote, called Crossing the Waters, Following Jesus Through the Storms, the Fish, the Doubt, and the Seas, was the winner of the 2017 Christianity Today Book Award for Christian Living Discipleship. So congratulations, Leslie Leland Fields. We're very happy for you, very proud of you, and so grateful again for having you on our show last month. Now let's get back to the exciting author we have this month on the Beyond the Cover interview with James Raines interviewing Anne Leckie. Here they are. Everybody gay, like
everybody could. Today on our show, we have Anne Leckie, who is the author of the Hugo, Nebula, and Arthur C. Clarke award-winning novel Ancillary Justice. She has also published short stories in Subterranean Magazine, Strange Horizon, and Realms of Fantasy. Anne, thank you for coming on our show, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
I grew up in St. Louis, which is where I live now. My family moved here pretty much when I was a baby, although in St. Louis, the thing that really counts is where you went to high school. So since I did go to high school in St. Louis, Rosati Kane, if there are any St. Louisans out there, then I count as a native St. Louisan.
What were some of your favorite things to learn when you were young?
Yeah, mostly things like ancient history, things like astronomy. Astronomy was a big interest of mine when I was a kid. I would have enthusiasms. Like at one point, I had a serious, long, extended detour into the Arthurian legends and really was digging up as much as I could, looking for translations of medieval stuff, reading all kinds of retellings. I would get very fixated on a particular topic, and there were just lots of those. But really, ancient history, history, anthropology, astronomy, those were really engaging to me.
Excellent. So you had mentioned Andre Norton as an author who inspired you. What authors have inspired you later in life?
It's kind of hard to say. I've occasionally thought about that. I thought it would be kind of nice to write a blog post about authors that I think are fabulous or that have really inspired me. And it can be really challenging to come up with names. I have very specifically picked out some authors to learn things from. One of those authors was Jack Vance. At one point when I was just sort of an aspiring writer and I was turning in stuff to an online critique group, somebody said to me, I can't see anything. There's no visuals. It's like everything's in black and white. And I said to myself, well, who does fabulous visuals? Well, Jack Vance does the most amazing visuals. And so I spent a lot of time very specifically reading his work for how he was getting his visual images down on the page. But of course, there's so much else in Vance. I love his work so much. He's a wonderful writer. Not exactly new. He left us a couple of years ago. He was like in his 90s, so it was probably time, but at the same time, a sad, sad loss. As far as newer writers, there are a lot of folks doing amazing work, and often I don't have as much time to read as I want to. I got into this writing partly because, among other things, I love to read so much, and when you read a lot, at least when I read a lot, it's hard for me not to also want to put out my own, you know, to discuss it or argue with it or react with it. So I got into this because I like to read. And now that I've been fairly successful at it, I have almost no time to just pick up something in the library and read. I get things sent to me that people want blurbs for and such. So I end up losing track of the things that are awesome. But there's so much neat stuff going on right now in science fiction. It's really incredible. I think probably every decade in science fiction, people could say that because it's always been just so many things going on and so many ideas for people to think about.
Where do you think your ideas come from for either your previous books or when you're thinking up a new book?
You know, it's kind of hard to say. That's a super interesting question because, of course, you have to start with an idea. I think sometimes ideas come very unconsciously. It's just a thing that you're sort of walking around and it hits the back of your mind and you say, well, what about, well, what if? Sometimes people talk about like, oh, such and such a person is so very creative, they have lots of ideas. But I think everybody has these ideas. The difference is that a writer looks at it and goes, oh, I could do something with that, and then does something with it. To some extent, the sort of ideas that just kind of bubble up, they come out of, sometimes I say this to people and they look at me funny, but you know when you're waiting in line, like at the post office, or you're bored and you don't have a book to read, and so you start telling yourself little stories just to kind of amuse yourself because you're bored? Apparently some people don't do that, which is perfectly fine, but it surprised me to discover that some people don't actually do that. That's actually a place where quite a few ideas come from. And when I have a particular request for a particular kind of story, very often I will very deliberately go to the library and I'll pick a topic, say, okay, ancient alien artifacts, well, where does that lead me? That leads me about archaeology. So I'll just start reading books about archaeology. Or I'll say, okay, somebody wants a story about elves. So I'll go to the library and I'll start reading about elves. And somewhere along the way, I'll trip over something that'll trigger a thought, oh, that's kind of cool. What could I do with that? So I feel like ideas come from two places. In one way, they just kind of come up out of inside of you from whatever your preoccupations are. But there's also a way to very consciously cultivate finding things that'll trigger those ideas.
Authors don't usually tend to write for fame or for wealth for obvious reasons. Or where does your satisfaction come from in writing?
That's a really super good question because you're right. Writing is not a get-rich-quick scheme or a get-famous-quick scheme. There's a joke I've heard it applied to other things. Do you know the difference between a large pizza and a science fiction writer?
I do not.
The pizza can feed a family of four. So people who do write, who continue writing, there has to be some other reason they're doing it. And I'm not 100% sure. I just feel like I want to tell these stories. Although I do find that it's super important to me that people will read it, potentially. And it's super important to me that it's as well done as I possibly can. I know for some folks, their priority is getting money for their writing, and other things are sort of subordinate to that. I discovered fairly early on that it was important to me that it be read, but more important that it be what I wanted it to be. There's not a right or a wrong about that. It's just my personal, how I feel about that. And I'm not sure what's driving that, but I do feel like almost every writer, the main goal is to communicate something to other people, to have other people read it, and to feel like maybe somebody's thinking about it and responding.
All right, so I have a copy of your book, Ancillary Justice, sitting in front of me. I don't know if you knew this, but at Barnes & Noble was offering this as a showcase. And so I actually have a copy at our library, and I've walked past it about a dozen times, and I thought, hey, I really like that cover. It's just
Isn't that a gorgeous cover? I love beautiful. That cover.
And I didn't pick it up at the library. I didn't pick it up at the library because I have a library stack. My library finds are through the roof. And so why did you choose science fiction as a genre to write in?
It wasn't really a conscious, I guess I should amend that. I was about to say it wasn't a conscious choice, but I had been writing fantasy and science fiction short stories, and that wasn't really a conscious choice. It was just that was the kinds of stories that were going to come out, because primarily that's what I've read, certainly when I was a kid. I've read other things, of course, you know, most of us have, but science fiction and fantasy just felt very comfortable to me. When I was writing short fiction, most editors would more readily buy my fantasy, and so I focused more on the fantasy. When I would have an idea, I would frame it in terms of fantasy because I knew that would be more likely to sell. But I thought of myself as a science fiction writer. I had wanted to write the ancillary books from the beginning. The short stories were in some ways a detour for me. And so I said, well, now it's time to sit down and write the novel. And I actually had friends of mine say, oh, you're going to write in your fantasy universe. And I said, no, I'm not. And some of my friends were a little bit disappointed, and some of them still want me to write in that fantasy universe, to write a novel in it. And I may. But I went to science fiction because that felt primarily like home to me. And I'm not exactly sure why. It may just be my history of having read science fiction as a kid. In a lot of ways, that's home territory for me.
Have you ever considered writing in a genre that maybe is a little bit different? Because I always feel like there's a connection or a correlation between fantasy and science fiction. And a lot of times you see elements of fantasy in science fiction and vice versa. Have you ever considered writing in a different genre than those two?
I have. And in fact, my very, very first writing sale ever was actually to True Confessions. I don't know if you remember True Confessions.
I do remember True Confessions.
Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore. And of course, there were like a half a dozen of them, True Confessions and True Love and True Romance and True Stories. And the reason I know that, I knew I wanted to write, but I didn't know anything about the science fiction magazine situation at the time. I had actually sent a couple stories out and gotten form rejections of science fiction. I was like 15. And then in my 20s, I said, well, there's all these magazines in the drugstore, and writing is writing. And so I bought like an armful of them, and I read them until my eyes bled. and then I proceeded to essentially do the literary equivalent of sticking my finger down my throat and just kind of barfing up everything I had just read. I sent it in, and they cut me a check for it. And it does not have a byline, because that was the thing with True Confessions, was they were supposedly all true stories. Mine totally was not true. I just signed a paper saying it was true, and it wasn't. I lied. And I'm sure most of the folks writing for those magazines lied, too. And it turned up, it was called He's My Lover on the Phone, But He's Never Seen My Face. And that was the first piece of writing that I ever actually got paid for. And then I said, oh, this is great, so I can do this. And I said, oh, now I'll sit down and do another one. And I was like, no, you know what? I really did not like writing that story. There's nothing wrong with those kinds of stories. It was very sort of semi-lurid, not really lurid romance. There's nothing wrong with that, and a lot of folks enjoy reading it, but it wasn't a thing that I enjoyed. And that was the beginning of my realizing that there wasn't any point writing for money if the writing wasn't something that I was having fun with.
So let's talk about awards. Your book has won several awards, and I don't really know much about some of these awards other than they're like the awards to win in the science fiction category. So could you explain a little bit about some of the awards your book has won, how that came about? Was there a ceremony?
Yeah, how it came about, I have no freaking idea. I was shocked. I spent that whole year in a constant state of feeling like I was hallucinating.
Okay.
The Hugo and the Nebula, in particular, are well-known awards in the science fiction reading community, and they are, and I'd say the Hugo maybe even more than the Nebula, but they both are, the kinds of things that you secretly fantasize to yourself about winning. You know, the way you have a secret fantasy, like you're in the bathroom or whatever, and you're like, yes, and I'm accepting my Nobel Peace Prize. And you're like, now I'm going to open the door and go out in public and nobody's going to know I had that super grandiose fantasy, right?
Yeah.
And so the Hugo and the Nebula are at that level, I think, for a lot of, if not all, science fiction and fantasy writers. The Hugo and the Nebula both do actually have ceremonies. For the Nebula, they've got their own little tiny little convention thing, and you go and there's a banquet that you know, eat hotel chicken, and they have a whole thing and a beautiful Lucite trophy. I think the Nebula is hands down the most beautiful of the trophies that I've seen so far. The Hugos are given out at the World Science Fiction Convention and voted on by the members of the World Science Fiction Convention. I think those are probably the oldest and sometimes call themselves the most prestigious, and I think it's probably true. The Arthur C. Clarke Award is sort of a relative newcomer. I think they may have started up in the late 80s or in the 90s.
Okay.
They're a British award, and they're awarded by a jury, and it's for things that came out in Britain that year, or in the UK, I should say, I guess. And I have often felt like they prefer a sort of a more literary side of science fiction, which I think is good because often the awards like the Hugos, while they do often award literary kinds of work, I think Michael Chabon has won a Hugo. It's a much more popular kind of sentiment to what those voters like, and the Arthur C. Clarke Award is kind of there to sort of help recognize another end of that spectrum. And when I saw that I was nominated for the Arthur C. Clarke, I was shortlisted, I was sure that I had no chance in the world. I thought, isn't that nice? That's really super awesome to be on the shortlist. It's not going to be me. And I was actually sitting on my couch in my bathrobe watching Twitter when they announced it. They have a little ceremony in London. It's just, you know, like some cocktails and they do some things and they announce. I literally swore my 10-year-old was home early from school and he didn't know what was up with me. And I was like, are you kidding me? So I believe the BSFA is the British Science Fiction Award. Those are given out by the members of, I think it's EasterCon, which is sort of a national convention that moves places in Britain the same way that Worldcon moves around the world. I think they have a little ceremony too. I didn't go to that because it was in the UK. The Locus is given out, they also have a little ceremony. The Locus is voted on by a poll of subscribers to Locus, which is a news magazine, basically, of the industry. They talk about science fiction publishing stuff and review books that are coming out. And there's almost always, at major conventions, there'll be a photographer taking pictures and say, oh, here's so-and-so at the Hugos. Oh, here's so-and-so at the Nebulas. Here's, you know. And so they do a poll and give out awards to the winners of the poll. And so Ancillary Justice won Best First Novel, which was just super amazing. I didn't go to that, but they have a lunch and they give out plaques. And almost every award, I think, that I've managed to be shortlisted for or win has some kind of little thing. I think in some cases they're meant to sort of help bring folks to a convention. You know, it's like, oh, well, we're going to go to Worldcon because we're going to go to the Hugos. And then in the meantime, you're at this awesome convention. My favorite of the awards, there are a lot of them. I'm still kind of stunned by that particular year. It was really amazing. The very first award that Ancillary Justice won was the Kitschies Golden Tentacle for Best First Novel. And that's an award that's, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
It's only been running for a couple of years. And the trophy is actually a hand-sewn stuffed gold satin tentacle with glittery little pom-poms glued on it for the suckers. And it also came with a bottle of rum.
Okay.
And that was really early in the year, and I won it, and I was so excited, and I was like, this is awesome. Look, my book won an award. Isn't this wonderful? And it's still, in a lot of ways, my favorite because, I mean, hand-sewn gold stuffed tentacle. You don't get more awesome than that, right?
So that's
definitely,
don't.
Right. It's a sentimental favorite of mine.
So this was your first novel, correct?
Yes, it was.
So right out of the gate, went in more awards than you can think of. How many authors can say that? I mean, how many authors can say, oh, my first book wins said awards? So many that, you know, I can't even go through all of them. That's rare. You don't usually hear
it
that.
It is rare. And I can tell you off the top of my head, I believe William Gibson did something similar with Neuromancer. And I believe Paolo Bacigalupi did not do shabbily either with The Wind-Up Girl, which was his first novel. But it's not really that usual. And actually, now that I think about it, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which didn't exactly win a raft of awards, but got a huge amount of critical acclaim and won the Hugo, is a first novel. So it does happen. But yeah, Ancillary Justice won a big raft of awards. It was pretty amazing.
Let's talk about writing them for a little bit. Do you write full-time or part-time?
I am lucky enough to write full-time. Not everybody can. I had always wanted to write from when I was a little kid. Obviously, I was sending things to True Confessions when I was in college. But I always kind of felt like my writing wasn't really very good. My ideas were really kind of stupid. I was wasting my time. I was busy with other things. And when I had my first kid, I discovered very quickly that if I went back to work, I would be losing money because childcare was more expensive than any job I ever had would actually pay me. So I stayed home. I love my kids, and I will tell you, I will fight you on this, my kids were the most adorable babies and toddlers that ever existed in the history of the universe, but they were not very intellectually stimulating. And so after a while, I started to feel like my brains were leaking out my ears, and I had to find something to do that was engaging my brain in a way that my kids weren't. And so that was when I said, well, why don't I settle down and try and do some writing?
Okay.
And because the internet had become a thing by then, I found a community of folks who were interested in writing, and that makes a huge difference when you have other people kind of interested in the same thing and kind of cheering you on, and you're cheering them on, and they're able to kind of read your stuff and say, oh, I liked this and I didn't quite like this so much. And it made a huge difference. And so that was when I really buckled down and started really seriously writing. And so when my kids hit school, I did go back to work as a lunch lady for a while, which is super awesome. But after a while, I said, you know what, it's time for me to fish or cut bait on the novel. And so I stayed home and I said, if the novel fails, it fails, and I can go back to being a lunch lady until the kids are old enough and then I can get a full-time job. And the novel didn't fail. So I'm super lucky to be able to stay home and write full-time.
Do you feel that authors stereotypically struggle in the workforce in the sense that they're not the normal 9-to-5 at the same company for 30 years until they retire? Is that something, a trend that maybe you see or felt in your own personal life?
Definitely one that I've seen, and definitely one that I've, as you say, I've had a bunch of really kind of odd jobs, and some of that was because I didn't want to really commit to a job that wasn't going to make me happy.
Okay.
I didn't want a 9-to-5 high-powered, you know, office job that was going to engage all of my emotions and thoughts and then leave me no time to write, because that was always kind of in the back of my mind. Even at the lunch lady, I had a great time as a lunch lady, and at one point they said, oh, we have the manager for this elementary school cafeteria has left. You could be the manager of the cafeteria. And I was like, no, I don't want to be the manager of the cafeteria. I don't want to have to worry about the cafeteria after I go home at night. And so it wouldn't surprise me if quite a few writers would rather save a particular part of their sort of processing power for writing. It also wouldn't surprise me if some number of writers are introverts and kind of slightly odd people and don't really find a comfortable fit in a lot of places, and that are actually kind of much happier and sort of more out of the way. I shouldn't say out of the way, because they're not, right? Waitresses are everywhere. Where would we be without truck drivers and garbage collectors? And, you know, I guess it's kind of doing a disservice to those jobs to call them odd, strange jobs or out of the way, because they're super important. But they do take a different kind of mental effort, and they do take a different kind of physical effort and a different kind of commitment, don't they? I suspect it's a combination of not wanting to commit to a job that might interfere with your writing, and also maybe not quite feeling like you're at home in certain kinds of situations. But I also know of writers who do the 9-to-5, so I don't know if it's really more prevalent or if it just stands out because there's that one group and you can see it in their bios right there. Not everybody you meet every day can you read their, you know, their little interesting job history.
When I first read that, it reminded me very much of Ernest Cline. I don't know if you're familiar with him, Ready Player One and Armada.
Mm-hmm.
His bio is very similar. And if I were to write a bio, it would be very, very similar.
When it came time for me to write the bio, that actually, and I've run into other writers who have had this, it's very sort of anxiety producing when you realize you have to have a bio.
Yes.
And you're like, well, what do I put in it? Because your life to you is just kind of your life. There's nothing exciting there, right?
Yeah.
Although somebody else could look at it and go, oh my gosh, did you really do all those cool things? And you're like, well, I was just bringing home a paycheck and, you know, washing dishes every night. And so I think a lot of us put those things in our bios because it's something different to put in the bio. And I do wonder if everybody was walking around with a tag of their job history on their shirt, you know, quite a lot of people would have some really interesting stories to tell and some really interesting backgrounds. So it may just be that is the effect. But also, you know, I do think a person who wants to write full-time is going to often be wary of committing too much to other things. Similar thing, folks who write short fiction in fantasy and science fiction, there's a standard cover letter that goes with your submissions when you're submitting fantasy and science fiction stories. And the standard form letter has a line at the bottom that goes, my fiction has previously appeared in X magazine. That's a super intimidating and scary thing to write a cover letter when you have no publications whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting and frightening. And the best thing is to just leave that line off, because editors understand, they know you have to start somewhere. But when I was looking at it as a new writer, I was like, but I don't have any publications. It was very upsetting. And I think writing your bio when it's your first need to have a bio, when you're going to have a short story published and the market wants it, or you have a book that you're putting out, it's that same kind of anxiety, but they don't care who I am, you know?
Yeah. Do you have any special time of the day that you write?
I'm usually more likely to get more done if I start in the morning. So once everybody else in the house is out the door for their day of stuff, is usually when I start the dishwasher and sit down to write. I can write at other times, and I found one of the pitfalls, actually, of being a full-time writer is that it's super easy for everything else to get in the way. You know, oh, somebody's got a fever and has to be picked up from school. Oh, there's laundry that needs to be done. Oh, somebody needs a dentist appointment. Oh, I need to get my hair cut. Oh, there's this, and next thing you know, the whole day is gone. And it's really easy for that to happen. So I try and preserve that morning hours for writing as much as I can. But it also, that flexibility also means that anytime I've got an hour or two free, I can sit down and write. I don't have to be at an office somewhere or anything.
Do you outline your stories, or do you start with an idea on paper and kind of let it take on a life of its own?
I have never actually produced an actual outline, although I was talking to a friend of mine who I know does do very detailed outlines. I am in awe of people who can outline. I'm sure it would probably save me a lot of grief, and I've never managed to do it. And my friend who outlines said, oh, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I start with, I have a basic idea. I know where I'm starting. I have a couple of landmarks on the way. I have a couple of moments. I know there's this particular thing is going to blow up at some point in the story. And this particular fight scene is going to happen at some point in the story. And I know I'm going to end with the president voted into office the way that we want it or whatever it is. But there's a huge blank space in between, and I don't know what it is. And my friend who outlined said, well, that's basically what I do, only I just have some more of those steps. But I kind of feel like I know where I want to end up, and between where I start and where I end up, I'm just driving in the space that my headlights illuminate, you know, just those couple steps ahead, and then I can see a little further, and then I can see a little further. Someday, I will manage to outline.
Okay.
Just to see what it's like.
I don't outline either, so I don't even know how it would even be possible. Outlines scare me.
Right? You know, how do I know what to put in the outline until I've written the scene to know what's going to happen?
So, from your first book, Ancillary Justice, to the second book, Ancillary Mercy, how was your writing, or how did your writing evolve?
That's a real good question. I find it really difficult to see my own writing very clearly, and so I find it difficult to talk about my own writing in that way. I did have a friend of mine say, who was reading the manuscript of the third book, said, you know, in the third book, the sentences are shorter. I said, really, are they? And she said, yeah, I think they are. They're shorter and less convoluted. Not as a good or a bad thing, because there's not a good or a bad difference between long, complicated sentences and short, straightforward ones. Just a thing that's different. But I'm sure my writing has evolved. It has to have. It's been a couple of years. I've written three books. But it's a difficult thing for me to see.
What do you think is the hardest thing about writing?
Oh, just sitting down and writing.
Okay.
Sitting down and writing is super hard. And to some extent, that sounds kind of silly, but it's really hard to do. And I'm not sure why. There's something about sitting down and getting your brain engaged in doing what it needs to do and writing. It's hard work psychologically. If there's any distraction nearby, it is amazing. I'm not a good housekeeper. I hate cleaning with the fire of 1,000 suns. And when I'm writing, I'll be like, oh, the kitchen floor needs mopping. Oh, I have to stop and scrub the shower. Oh, there's laundry that needs doing. I mean, normally I'm like, the kitchen floor, I'm just not going to look at it as I walk through the kitchen, right? But when I'm writing, it's like, oh, but these other urgent things have to be taken care of. I know I'm not alone in that. Other writers who I know call that cat vacuuming. When you sit down to write and you're like, oh, but the cat needs vacuuming. I really have to clean this one thing. And that's really super difficult. I'm not sure why that is, but once I get going, once the words start going and I feel like I'm making progress, then it's much easier. But that initial sitting down and starting to work is a bar that's really difficult to cross.
Cat vacuuming. I've never heard of that.
Isn't that a wonderful, it's just a perfect phrase, like completely useless housekeeping tasks that have to be done, right?
Cat vacuuming. Maybe they need to be vacuumed. I don't know.
See, you'd have an excuse to vacuum the cat, right?
For me personally, I always thought it was just the fear of you're not going to do a good job. That's kind of what always seems
Oh, yes, absolutely. New writers, that's a huge boundary to new writers. I think folks like you and I, who we know that we can write anyway, despite mm-hmm. of those little voices, we've gotten over that hump. But I think for new writers who are trying to start, it's really easy to tell yourself, well, if I feel that way, it must be because I'm not a good writer and my favorite writers don't feel that way. And so I think it's maybe kind of good for new and aspiring writers to hear that actually a lot of writers feel that way. Their favorite writers probably feel that way. Their favorite writers probably look at a blank page and they've got that little voice in the back of their head saying everything you do stinks and your ideas are stupid. And because that was a big barrier to me when I was much younger. Now I know that voice is going to talk no matter what, and and I can say, yeah, you're all talk, and I can turn the music up, and I can keep writing, and it will be all right. But that voice can be really loud sometimes and very upsetting. That is really difficult.
Now you bring out your book cover.
Doesn't shut it up completely. Oddly, I was talking to somebody, and they're like, well, you'd think all the awards would have, you know, shut that little voice up. And I'm like, actually, it didn't. But it does make it easier for me to say, yeah, you're all talk, no bite.
Not very familiar with Orbit books. Could you tell me a little bit about them and the process of them selecting your book?
So Orbit is an imprint of Hachette. They were originally a UK-only company and expanded over to the US a little while ago, but fairly recently. They've become a pretty important imprint for science fiction and fantasy. Basically, I did the sort of thing you're supposed to always do, which is I queried agents. Once I had a final manuscript for Ancillary Justice, I wrote a query letter, and query letters ought to be illegal. They're so hard to write. They're terrible. You have to boil your book down to 200, 300 words, and nothing sounds good in 300 words.
No.
Well, except a 300-word story. But you're boiling 100,000 words down to 300 words? No, it's not going to sound good. And that was really very difficult. For folks who are about to go through that, actually, there's a website called Query Shark. And it's an agent who runs it, and people submit their query letters, and the agent actually will critique the query letters, and then they'll rewrite them and send them back in, and then she'll critique those. And I read, like, the entire archives of Query Shark, and by the time I was done, I knew what a query letter was supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote my own after much weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth and sent that out to agents and got an agent that way. And so my agent submitted the manuscript around to folks. It was really an interesting process. Not everybody feels like they need an agent, and that's cool. Certainly, if you're self-pubbing, you may or may not need an agent, and that's awesome. For me, it was super important to have him there, partly because he knew who the editors were and knew how to negotiate, but also because when I would feel really upset and anxious and be worried that the book would never sell, because I was convinced the book would never sell, but when you're a writer, you submit it anyway, right? You don't worry about whether it will sell or not. You send it out because your feelings don't necessarily match reality. And so I would be upset and think it's never going to sell, and I would feel very anxious and be wanting to check my email box all the time to see if anybody had said anything. And I would sit down and say, no, my agent, it's his job to deal with that. That's what I hired him for. And for some reason, that actually helped for me to be able to say, I don't have to worry about it because my agent will worry about it.
Yeah.
Actually, I told him about that at one point, and he started laughing. He was like, yeah, that's what we're here for. So he did all of that stuff. So what usually happens, an agent will submit your book around. If an editor shows interest, then they will set up a call between you and the editor. I actually talked on the phone with three different editors from three different places, including Orbit. And you have this phone conversation, and the editor will talk about your book and what they think about it and maybe what changes they kind of think might be appropriate for it. Nobody's committing to anything. It's just kind of a get-to-know-you thing. At the end of that phone call, the editor is going to think harder about how hard they want to push for this book. Do they want to try and convince the publishing house to make an offer? At least one of the folks I talked to got off the phone with, and I was like, yeah, he's a nice guy, but I can't work with him. And he obviously got off the phone and thought the same thing of me.
Yeah.
And no hard feelings, because it would have been a disaster if we'd worked together.
Yeah.
And then my agent contacts me, and it's like, they don't want to make an offer. And I'm like, yeah, I know. So those phone calls are kind of super scary and stressful, because from the writer point of view, you totally want to sell your book. And so you're like, I want to appear the best I can, and I want to be super smart, and I want to be super professional, and I want to really impress this editor. But the editor also kind of wants to impress you.
Yeah, it's like a job interview. Yeah,
it's like a job interview. And so it's scary that way. But once that goes down, then the editor has to go to, there's a committee, I guess, there's marketing and all these others, and the company as a whole has to sign off and say, yes, we want to invest in this book. And sometimes the editor can really, really love it, and marketing and whatnot says, no, we can't see our way clear, and they can't make an offer. That's one of the realities of being a writer. It's a thing that happens, and it's sad. So basically, I had my phone calls, and then whoever was going to offer offered, and then we made our pick to who to go to, and I went with Orbit, and I've been super happy with Orbit. I think they've done a fabulous job. I think they've treated me really well. I occasionally will hear writers talk about how they feel their publishing houses have left them to do all the marketing, for instance, and I don't feel that way about Orbit at all. I have a great publicist at Orbit. I think she does a fabulous job. So I've been really, really happy.
Where can we find out more information about you and your books?
I have a website, annlecky.com. No spaces, no underscores, and there's no E on the Ann either. People often put it on, understandably. And my mom meant me to have one, but whoever typed out the birth certificate didn't put it, so there's no E on the Ann.
Okay.
I have a Twitter account.
Okay.
I do have Facebook, but I almost never go to Facebook. My Twitter is Ann_Lecky.
Okay.
And actually, I'm on Tumblr as Ann Lecky, which has been a lot of fun.
Okay. What advice would you give to aspiring writers?
Mostly, I would say keep going. I've heard it said, the published are the persistent. And also, any book you read that you admire or story that you admire is basically free source code for you to look at and steal from. So if somebody you admire is doing something you really like, stop and look at that. That technique is there for you to take.
Okay.
It's right there on the page. And just keep going and keep trying to get better and keep submitting no matter what and just be very patient.
Before we close, is there anything else that you wanted to add for our listeners?
Any of you who are writers, like I said, keep writing. It's just important to keep going on. Writing takes so much patience and so much endurance, and it's psychologically difficult sometimes to get so much rejection or even no response at all. But if it's what you want to do, it's worth doing, so keep doing it.
Thank you very much, Anne, for being on our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Thanks again, Ann Lecky and James Rains, for that fantastic interview. For those of you joining us late in the show, we were just listening to James Rains interview Ann Lecky, who is the author of the space opera trilogy Ancillary Justice, Ancillary Sword, and Ancillary Mercy, published in 2013, 14, and 15. She also writes fantasy and science fiction short stories as well. Ancillary Justice was the winner of the Hugo Award, the Nebula Award, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, the British Science Fiction Association Award, the Locus Award, the Kitschies Award, and the Siyun Award. And then the sequel, the second book in the series, Ancillary Sword, won the Locus Award the next year. So we're very grateful to have this fantastic writer on our show. Thanks again, Ann Lecky and James, for that great Beyond the Cover interview. If you want more information about Ann Lecky and her stories and books, you can visit her website at www.annlecky.com, and you'll find plenty of information on there, as well as where her books are available for sale. You can also pick up her book at your Kodiak Public Library. Next up on our show, we have Erin Starr Hollow from the Kodiak Arts Council, and she's here to chat with me a little bit about a project we're both very excited about, and that is the altered book season that is now upon us.
Yes.
So, Erin, tell us a little bit about what you know about altered books.
Well, my understanding of the origination story is that it came about through the efforts of generating the new library funding, and there was so much creative effort that went into that process. And I believe it was originally a joint effort between the Arts Council and the Library Association, somehow celebrating art and literature. And it's another one of our great opportunities for community art shows to recruit art through all levels of the community. You know, we have some professional artists and some people who maybe have never done anything like this before. And it's really beautiful to see all those efforts come together in this cooperative art show. And it's a really great way to brighten up our winters.
That's true. There are some amazing artists in town. We have to give a shout out. Jacqueline Madsen is actually helping us pretty significantly this year and last year with the art show. And if you stop by the Kodiak Public Library, there is a beautiful piece of professionally commissioned altered book art there at the library for you to take a look at, some of the highest caliber of the projects we receive. But like Erin said, anybody is welcome to do a project. We're very excited to see every project out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we also have Natasha Priestess helping with this effort again this year, who I don't know how many years those two have been involved.
Right, those two have been involved for more years than you and I have been. We're very happy for their help.
It's really fun to see their efforts come together. You know, some of these professional artists who know this is coming every year get some time to put thought into it, and it's pretty fun to see their efforts come together.
And we usually get a lot of submissions too from students, which we're very happy about to see what the kids are making. So this is definitely open for all ages. If you've got little kids at home that you want to have them work on an altered book project, it can be as simple as a few hour project or something that takes you the whole month to do.
Yeah, and actually, so one of the things we do at our opening reception, which will be February 3rd during the First Friday Art Walk at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium foyer. All the people who come in get the chance to vote for the People's Choice Awards. It's just an informal, like, what's your favorite? It doesn't have to be the most skilled. It doesn't have to be the most beautiful. Just whatever speaks to you the most. And we have prizes for various categories of winners in that contest. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting last year is some of the winners, we didn't know the ages. We just had two categories, adults and youth. And some of the youth winners were some of the youngest people. And we didn't know that until they came in to collect their prizes. So it was really cool to see the effort that some of these kids were able to put into their projects. And they're, you know, really creative, really beautiful.
It's true. And you never know what's going to speak to the people. So don't be shy. Create whatever kind of altered book project that you want. Like Erin said, that's February 3rd from 5 to 7 mm-hmm. at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. And there's mm-hmm. going to be voting on mm-hmm. the projects, and there's going to be
music
and yeah. nibbles. Yeah. So it's definitely worth stopping by and checking out all the projects that are mm-hmm. on. And if you're an artist, you want to have your submission to Erin by February 1st at 4 p.m. so mm-hmm. they have time to get it up.
Yeah. And, you know, the earlier the better. They can come in at any time throughout the month. Some people, you know, drop them off really early. You can bring them up anytime, Monday through Friday from 10 to 4 to our office. Or, you know, if we are in touch, you can contact me and we can arrange any way to pick them up. But yeah, just as long as they're in by February 1st, that gives us a chance to incorporate them into the show and get them tagged and labeled right. And, you know, we also have the opportunity to sell them for artists. And, you know, that gives us a chance to label them and prepare them for sale. And if you are a community member who's interested in buying a piece from the show, you want to be at the reception too. So you make sure that you have the best selection still available.
That's right. So if you're an artist and you're working on your project, you might want to be thinking about whether or not you want to sell it. And if so, what price you're thinking of. And then all the rest of you out there who want to liven up their living room with a little project, mm-hmm. definitely come out mm-hmm. on February 3rd.
Yeah, it should be a really great show. And, you know, last year we had a great turnout. We had great music, which we will again. And Big Al's was really generous, and they had a really creative spread of appetizers. And they even made altered book art as dishes for this show. And they are supporting us again. So I want to give them a big thank you.
Yeah, there will be Big Al's catered food there. Not necessarily pizza. Come and be surprised by what you'll see. And if you haven't quite finished your altered book project, there's an opportunity next Saturday at the Kodiak Public Library from noon to 4 to come down and work on your project. We'll have some books there that can be altered, and there'll also be some crafting supplies. So even if you haven't started a project, this is a great opportunity to come down and get one going. Or if you've got one but you're not quite finished it, bring it down. We'll be there. Jackie'll be there. You can get some input and some encouragement and motivation to get that project finished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's so good. Every time I go to any of her workshops or just watch her work at all, I learn something new, and I end up incorporating some really great techniques into my own projects at home. So it's a great opportunity, just very casual. You know, she's just providing inspiration and demonstrations, an opportunity to work around other artists. So it's a really neat program. And you can also find us on Pinterest, and we have an altered book inspiration board that'll give community members ideas. I believe we're under Kodiak Arts Council or Kodiak Arts. Yeah, we've been just putting things up here and there as long as we've been planning this year's show. So it's a great opportunity to get the gears working.
Yeah, definitely. If you need ideas, check Pinterest out. There's a fantastic array of ideas on there. And we can't stress this enough. Your project doesn't have to be Pinterest quality.
Mm-mm.
This can just be something you put together in a few hours. It can be small. I had a friend actually that did an altered book project at a little get together we had. He did it in 2 to 3 hours, and it looks fantastic. So you don't have to feel like this needs to take you the whole month. If you just want to have a fun crafting afternoon and put mm-hmm. something together, we'd be happy to see that art
yeah,
as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Any level. I mean, it can be from origami to a vast multimedia effort. It can be anything. It can be a drawing on a book page. It can be anything. We really just love to see community artists, amateur, professional, totally inexperienced, whatever. We just like to generate that effort in the community and participate education. And yeah, it's just, it's such a great thing to get to see what people are capable of here. It's a really creative community.
And we're always really happy with all of the projects that come in. So please share our enthusiasm.
Yes.
And even if you don't make a project, come and check them out on February 3rd.
Come vote.
You would be surprised at the amazing things that people in this town can create. Mm-hmm. I am always surprised at the creativity, originality, and heart that goes into these projects.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a great community.
So again, February 3rd is the opening at Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium from 5 to 7 p.m. That's the first Friday next month. That's where you come and vote for the People's Choice on these altered book projects. And then this Saturday, January 14th, from 12 to 4 at the Kodiak Public Library is where you have a little chance to finish off those crafting projects if you're not quite done yet.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you can turn your projects in all month, this month, and leading up all the way through February 1st at 4 p.m.
If you need more information, they've got that on the website for the Kodiak Arts Council. Mm-hmm. And you can always email Erin too.
Yep. You can email me, erin@kodiakartscouncil.org. And we also have a Facebook presence. We have an Instagram presence. Yeah, you can find us anywhere. Call our office, come into our office.
Yeah. You can find that information on the Kodiak Public Library Association's Facebook page, website as well. But we're just going to direct you right over to the Kodiak Arts Council. This is something that Erin's been putting a lot of effort in. And so she's the point person on this.
It's one of my favorite parts of my job.
And we're so happy to be working with her. We really appreciate your input, Erin.
It's a great group. I really love working with this group.
All right, everyone. That's it. The Altered Book Month is upon us. We want to see you out there on February 3rd. Thanks, Erin.
Thank you.
Before I continue on, I want to give you all the information for how you can contact the Kodiak Public Library Association if you want to find out more information about what we're doing with this show, Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA, or if you're interested in helping out, if you have some ideas of some authors we could interview on our Beyond the Cover segment, or if you want to become a member of the Kodiak Public Library Association and help support your local library, we'd love to hear from you. You can find us online. Our website is www.kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org. You can email us at kpla.alaska@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. So check us out, Kodiak Public Library Association. We're very proud to be doing this show. We would love your member involvement and support, and definitely we want to see you out supporting your Altered Book show again this February 3rd. We're also having our annual meeting coming up in the next few months. We'd like to see you there too. So if you have any interest in supporting your library or the KPLA board, please get in touch with us. All right, Kodiak, next up is Lively Live Chats. I'm pretty excited about this because this is a book that I have enjoyed very much reading lately. Today, we have Kaylin Morrison from the Kodiak Public Library. She's joining me to talk about a book that she actually recommended that I read when I came into the library one time. I read it, and it was a fantastic book. It was one of the best young adult books I've read this year, so I thought I'd have Kaylin in, and she could share with all of you why we liked this book so much. So this book is by Maggie Steifvater, and it's called The Scorpio Races. Do you want to tell us about it, Kaylin?
Sure, of course. The Scorpio Races is a book about a race that happens every year. I'm assuming in November, but they're not very specific about when exactly it happens. And it happens on this island off the coast of England. And again, this is another assumption. What I really like about it is the sense of place is really real. You feel this island, but they don't specifically say where it is either. So Scorpio races happen once a year. Traditionally, only men have run in the Scorpio races. And it's about the first teenage girl or young woman who runs in the Scorpio races. And it's definitely, I would say, a typical coming of age story, but it's told in a beautiful lyric way that I think a lot of people here in Kodiak can relate to.
Yeah, there's definitely a strong theme through it of being in a small island, very rural living, and having to decide as a young person if you want to stay or if you want to go to the mainland and take all the opportunities that that might offer you and what you might leave behind, or whether or not you can do that in your heart, in your spirit, ideas that really would translate to Kodiak living. And I just noticed when I looked at this book's published date, it was published in 1981. I had no idea when I was reading it that it was written that long ago. There is no dating at all to it. This could have been written last year. It could have been written in 1981. I wouldn't have known. And the other thing about this that Caitlin pointed out to me when I came to the library that was a real selling point is that this is a standalone book. So many young adult books these days are series.
Right.
And this one stands alone. Maggie Stiefvater actually writes some other series that are really good. But this book is the cream of the crop, I think. Like Caitlin said, this is the story of the first girl to run in this race. But the other really fascinating part of this book is the horses that they're racing on. So Caitlin, tell us about that.
The horses that they race on are called Kapil Ishka. And I actually had a little advantage here over Athenia because I first was introduced to this story on audio. So I kind of knew how to pronounce Kapil Ishka. These horses are, you know, a traditional folk water horse that are a little carnivorous, I guess I could say. And they tend to really like to go after red meat, whether it be humans or a dog on the beach. And only certain people are able to tame these horses to run them. And actually, the other main character's point of view is Sean, who is, I guess, an old hand at tending them, but he's actually only 18. And it's about, you know, he's trying to figure out how he can stay on the island and how he can stay working with these horses that he loves. And he's a perennial winner of this race. So it's about Sean and then the first girl who runs, Puck, and about their relationship and their relationship to the island and their families.
And then, of course, at the race, they become rivals, even though outside of the race, they are quite close friends. It's pretty interesting. The carnivorous aspect of the horses, I don't want to underplay. In fact, they are quite scary. There's one particular scene. I don't know if you know this scene, Caitlin, mm-hmm. but they're at a picnic. Puck is at a picnic with her little brother, and they're just, you know, having a quiet time. And then they kind of hear like, whoomph, whoomph, whoomph from yep. the tent behind them. And they both look at each other and they're like, oh, no. And then they see the horse's head come around the side of the tent and yep. look at them. And they know that they're about to get attacked. And then they hear the like little like,
the cat.
The cat's running across the field with its tail up like, hey guys, where are you? I want to join you. And I actually, after that scene, I had to put the book down. I almost started to cry.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because I'm partial to cats, but it was scary. And I said that to my husband. He was leaving and I'm like, oh no, they're going to kill the cat. And I explained the whole scene to him. I was so moved by it. And then he went to work and I kept reading and I actually ended up texting him, don't worry, the cat does not die. Because it is kind of scary. And the cat does not die, but there are humans that do. There is some death. And a lot of young adult fiction has death, but I found this to be more visceral. It seemed like they did a really good job of making you understand how dangerous these horses are that they're trying to tame. There is a big element of only certain people can capture them out of the water.
Right.
Only certain people can tame them. And then even once they're tamed, once you're riding them, especially along the beach, the closer you get to the ocean, the less tame they are, and they can kind of turn on you at any second, even the most tame horse. So that part does come with a little bit of a trigger warning. Yeah.
Yes, both Puck and Sean's parents have both died from one of these Kapil Ishka attacks, and they tend to get more active right around the time of the races. So I think it's part of a tradition on the island. I'm assuming it's also a very much a rite of passage for a lot of these men who run in the races. Yeah. So what really captured me about this book is just how beautiful, like I said, that sense of place is. It can be, like I said, off the coast of England, off the coast of Massachusetts, maybe off the coast of Alaska.
Yeah, the location is a strong character in the book. That is a good point.
I do have to recommend the audiobook, too, if anyone is a big audiobook listener. They do two different voices, one for the female main character, Puck, and one for the male main character, who is Sean. And both of the narrators do an excellent job of the scenes.
Yeah. I read it. I don't do a lot of audiobooks, but I really enjoyed the print version. And you can get both the print and audio version at the Kodiak Public Library.
Yep.
So, yeah, if there's anybody out there interested in a coming-of-age story of a young girl who breaks the mold in her small town and races on a carnivorous... Actually, I guess we should mention that.
Yeah.
She does not race a water horse. She chooses to race her mare that she's grown up with that is very tame and not particularly fast. And her theory behind it is that having a mount that you can trust and having a partnership with your horse, that maybe her horse will be more reliable in the race than a horse that could turn at any second.
Most riders in the race do capture that horse 2 months beforehand, a month beforehand, and there's not a lot of time to make that bond. But that's a good point, because I believe Sean, he's been winning a lot in the previous years. I believe one of the reasons is because he happens to have a really close connection with his Kapalishka. He's been working with that water horse for years and years, and you can tell.
And she, for a minute, tries to ride on a water horse herself, and it doesn't go well, which leads her to choose to ride the horse that she grew up with. So that's also a really interesting dynamic of, you know, breaking the mold more than just being a female in a male-dominated race, but also riding a standard horse in a race meant for these carnivorous water horses. So a very interesting book. I think a lot of young girls might enjoy this for that aspect. And, you know, the young adult boys, they're going to like this too, because it's fast action, like the plot's moving quickly. There is relationship drama, but it's not the central focus of the book. The central focus is this race. So the boys out there will like it too. I recommend this for all the young adults out there, and then all the way up to adults, because Caitlin and I also both really enjoyed this book.
Yes, and I only read it myself 3 years ago at most too, so I just discovered it way after it was printed.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so again, that book is called The Scorpio Races by Maggie Stiefvater. And if you're interested in the other things she's written, she also wrote the Shiver series and
the Raven Boys series.
The Raven Boys series. So if you are familiar with either of those series too, you might like this book as well. Check it out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Caitlin, for coming in.
See you later.
All right, Kodiak, that's just about going to wrap up our show for tonight. I want to remind those of you out there that have Friday afternoons off that this month on January 13th, Friday in the afternoon, the Kodiak Public Library will be showing BFG, The Big Friendly Giant. It's going to be playing at the library from 3 to 4:45 p.m. That's a fantastic movie that the library has brought in. We're really excited to see it. So if you've got some time that afternoon, or if your kids have got some time that afternoon, please remember to drop by the library and see that. And then this Saturday, the KPLA is having its altered book crafting workshop from noon to 4 p.m. So if you're not excited yet for your altered book projects, this is the time to get excited, get inspired, get your project going, and get ready for the big altered book projects viewing on first Friday next month, February 3rd from 5 to 7 in the afternoon. We're working with the Kodiak Arts Council on that. We're very excited for that event. So please come by on Saturday and work on your altered book projects if you haven't got them done already. There's still a couple more times you can show up for Bob Ross's Drawing for Shy People workshop. That's happening Tuesdays and Thursdays at 6 p.m. If you haven't signed up for that yet, it's a super fun time. You should check it out. The Winter Read kickoff is this month, and we want to remind you that this is the perfect time of year to cozy up under a blanket and read some good books. The Kodiak Public Library is helping to support that. They've got a campaign going right now. So stop by your library, get some books, see what it's all about. And there's lots of other events happening at the Kodiak Public Library. You can find their calendar by visiting the website www.city.kodiak.ak.us/library. It's a great resource. They've got their calendar on there, their catalog on there, and a lot of other great resources and information. So please check out the library website. My name is Athenia. I'm chair of the Kodiak Public Library Association, Kodiak's Friends of the Library group. And on behalf of my board, the KPLA, we would like to say thank you for listening to another episode of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales. And we want to wish you a 2017 filled with fantastic books. So until next month, happy reading. Simple little bookworm.
this librarian. Take off those glasses and let down your hair for me. So I'll watch you through the bookcase, imagining a scene. You and I at dinner, spending time then asleep. And what then would I say to you, lying there in bed? These words with a kiss I would plant in your head. What is it inside our